Birth, Chapter 24. "We're 100 miles out from the airstrip," said the pilot over the cabin intercom. "Please stow everything and make sure your seatbelt is fastened." The team was tired still as they each woke up from their 2-hour nap. Kyle folded his laptop closed and slipped it into the pouch of the seat in front of him. Orphan was sitting near the rear of the cabin, and he was the 6th member of the team. "Can you tell me a little more about what you saw?" asked Loretta. "Well, I was standing on the highest tower of the rig, the Deepwater, with my roommate. It was nearly dawn, and the view from up there is amazing. We could see the horizon, just barely, and these 2 waves passed by. They were huge, like 2 humps of seawater traveling, I don't know, about 100 miles an hour. The whole rig tilted back and forth, and the casing failed. The gas pressure burst by the blowout preventers and caught fire. The explosions destroyed the rig and killed 11 men. I escaped. My roommate was killed," he explained in the short version. "The waves, were they close together?" she probed further. "Well, yeah, I suppose. They were like traveling together. I don't know how far apart they were, but they were about 100 feet high," he said, using his hands to show the distance. "The first one kicked the rig one way, and the second one kicked it the other way." "Which way were they going?" "Well, that was what was so weird. The sea was calm and quiet. There was no wind at all, like black glass out there. And this is deep water, more than a mile. These waves were headed southeast, I would say. Nothing can make deep water surge like that," he explained with all the authority a 19-year-old oil rig worker could muster. "Well, nothing except a gravity wave coming from inside the planet," said Rhino, cutting into the conversation. "I did the math models. The 2 planets begin to emit harmonic waves of tremendous power. The model predicts that they will show up in the oceans at first." "What does he mean by first?" asked Kyle of Dick. "I mean, first seems to say there might be a second." "I think that is what he means, dude," said Dick. "What do you say, Doc?" "Well," began Loretta, "my hypothesis is that somewhere around the 3rd full moon of 2016, that's the way the cyclic calendar works it out, the 2 Earths are scheduled to begin their dissidence," she said flatly, hoping she didn't have to speak for a full semester to bring this crowd up to speed. "That's like Easter," said Dick. "More like Passover," said Kyle. "Ask a Jewish boy about phases of the moon and see what you'll get," he said, waving his hand like a circle. "You guys are closer than you know," said Bet, finally joining in. "The precession is a full cycle of star alignments that last for about 26,000 years. I did the astronomical alignment calculations for Dr. Wesson's thesis." Up until now, she thought, she had been nothing but a conspiracy theorist trying to expose Smith and Jones. Everyone except Orphan had seen her bad side. She felt it was time they got to see how valuable she was to the team as a grad student. "You might want to save this for the president," said Smith. "He has your thesis. But there are assumptions that are not explained," he said, pointing toward the rear cargo area. "His team needs that information back there to be able to do their job." "And what might that be?" asked Bet. "What exactly is their job?" she asked with renewed suspicion. "I have read for years about government contingency plans with your underground bases and special lists for certain elites that get admission while the rest of us get fried up here on the surface." She sounded like she was just getting wound up. "Okay, hold it," said Loretta. "We've been through a lot the last 24 hours. We've seen a lot. I think they all have expended nearly superhuman effort to see that we make it to this meeting. And they sound like they really need to know what we know. Let's try to show a little respect here," she said with all the leadership she could muster. "Okay," said Bet as she slid back in her seat away from the fight she had tried to start. Smith turned around to face the cabin. "We will be landing soon. You need to know that we are not out of the woods yet. We need to reach the Camp David access door to Site R. It is located about 1 mile from the airstrip. Our team members will be there to help us. Make sure we leave nothing behind. All those records and things in the back have to make it as well, said Smith. We are on approach and have clearance to land, said the pilot over the intercom. The jet began slowing as the pilot reduced the throttle. The flaps began to grab the cool, moist air typical with the spring day in Maryland. Formerly known as the Naval Support Facility, it has been the favorite retreat for presidents since Roosevelt. President Obama preferred the warm tropical beaches of Hawaii and never visited Camp David. The landing gear doors opened and the wheels whined their way into position. There was no turbulence to speak of as the pilot lined up the jet with the long and wide airstrip. Since 1943, the facility had received hundreds of millions in black budget money to build the Raven Rock Mountain Center that was EMP and missile-proof. It was deep under the hills with blast doors and a system of ventilation and accommodations to preserve the command and control during Cold War conditions and beyond. The jet touched down and immediately began slowing and turning toward the side of the runway. The jet didn't taxi all the way to the tarmac to general aviation. Smith, you better get up here, said the pilot over the intercom. Smith quickly unfastened his belt and leaped into the cockpit doorway, grabbing the door jamb to steady himself. Are we going to GA? Asked the pilot. Good question. Smith held his wrist up to his mouth and spoke into his watch. Let's hope he's in range. Hadid? We're on your 3 o'clock, came the reply over the watch speaker. Smith pointed to the two white vans that were approaching the runway by driving on the taxiway. The pilot stood harder on the brakes and made the turn down the taxiway connector and off the runway. That's them, said Smith. Okay, then, who are those guys? Said the co-pilot, pointing to the other side of the runway near the end. There were four vehicles in desert paint approaching the far end of the runway about a mile away. I make that to be two troop carriers and two Humvees with 50s on top, said Smith. I gather they're not part of the welcoming party, said the pilot. Can you get us back in the air? Asked Smith, and quickly he shouted, Jones, we got problems. I see 'em, yelled Jones from the cabin, leaning now against the front port window of the jet. Can't get up from here. I need more runway. Then go that way, said Smith, pointing to the forest about 300 yards away. Let me out. I can't do you any good in here, said Jones, pulling on the door handle and cranking it over. We're turning, said the pilot, standing on the right pedal and applying the left motor. You're going to have to close that door, shouted the pilot over the screaming jet engine. Everyone in the cabin covered their ears, and Jones dived out the door and rolled to his feet outside beyond the tip of the wing. Smith grabbed the door and pulled on it. Rhino jumped out of his seat and grabbed the door next to Smith and pulled it close. I got it, sir, he said. Hey, buddy, do you think you can pick up anything? Dick said to Kramer. Good question, said Kyle, opening his laptop and waiting for it to boot up. Jones could be seen running toward the two vans as Hadid opened the back of the first van. They were pulling a trunk out onto the ground and opening the lid. We have to move, said Smith to the pilot. Take us toward the woods, over there. We need cover and to get out of this plane. Hey, there is nothing on the air from these guys. They ain't saying anything over the radio, popped Kyle as his scanning program was running. Let me try something else. What about the fuel management? Those are diesels, said Dick. Yeah, hold on, said Kyle as he furiously dragged and tapped his finger around the touchpad. Go, go, punch it, said Smith, slapping the shoulder of the pilot. I can go, but we might not be able to stop once we leave this pavement, he answered as he gripped the yoke in anticipation of the rougher surface. A small jet has a small tiller crank by the left of the pilot and right of the co-pilot. You're going to have to help me with this. I'm ready to follow your lead, said the co-pilot. There's no feedback to the operator. The tiller simply directs the hydraulic pressure of the nose wheel steering gear. It takes practice, even with a stripe to follow on the pavement. Too much lateral pressure will snap the strut loose from the airframe. Let's stay out of the tall grass. There could be soft places that will bury the nose wheel. Got it, said the co-pilot. What do we have in the case? Asked Jones, sliding up to Hadid with his slick dress shoes on the pavement. He didn't realize how fast he was running, but the excursion force at the end of the runway would be within range in less than 2 minutes. "I have an M60 and a mix of phosphorus and depleted uranium rounds," said Hadid. "Damn, that's heavy enough for hard work. You're going to have to hold it. We don't have time to mount it," said Hadid. The second van was chasing the jet and almost caught up with it. John was at the wheel and Enoch was sitting in the passenger seat. "They're heading for the trees," said John. "Pull up beside the pilot's side. He can't see us. We'll get him to stop," said Enoch. John floored the van and it bounced with the off-road conditions and spun a cloud of dirt up behind the van. Enoch rolled his window down and waved his arm to get the pilot's attention. "Hey, Smith," yelled Rhino, "there's a van next to us." "Oh, that's good, that's good. Stop the plane right here," said Smith, putting his hand back on the pilot's shoulder. The pilot stood on the brakes, and the plane lurched in the hard dirt to a stop. "Everyone in the van, right now, go, go, go." Rhino snapped the door handle open and flung the air stair down. He jumped down the stairs and ran back to the cargo area behind the wing. The port engine was still winding down and making an awful noise. Loretta and Bet were next down the stairs and ran for the open side door of the van. John grabbed their hands and helped them into the van to the seats. Rhino arrived at the back of the van with 3 boxes. "There's more," said Rhino to Enoch, who turned to run with Rhino to return to the plane. "Let's go, guys," said the pilot to Dick and Kyle, who were huddled around his laptop screen. "Go on. We just have something to do. You won't leave us, right?" said Dick. "You have just a few seconds," said the pilot as the next one to pass them. "Come on, guys. We must go now," said Smith. "They will be here in less than a minute, and it won't be pretty." "Oh, it'll be more than a minute," said Kyle. "I just shut their fuel pumps off. Now we can go." Dick stood up with Kyle right behind him, and they jumped through the door of the van. Rhino and Enoch had the last of the boxes from the cargo area as they ran for the van. At that moment, there was a whizzing sound as rounds began flying past them in the grass. Jones returned fire with the M60 from the first van, just to let them know they were not unarmed. "You guys go on. We'll hold them here," yelled Jones. "No need, no need. Their vehicles are down. Fuel systems," said Smith, pointing to Kyle, who grinned and held up his laptop. "Let's go." "Rhino, can you give me a hand?" yelled Jones from the other van. "You demand, Jones," he said, favoring his weak leg to get over to the first van. "These rear windows tilt out, but they're bulletproof. Can you remove this one?" Rhino unlatched the passenger side back glass of the van door, swinging the bottom of it out. His massive hands wrapped around the glass and snapped it free from the upper hinge. He tossed it away into the grass. "Like this?" "You are the man, my friend," said Jones. "Get in." Jones tossed the M60 machine gun into the van next to the ammo can with the belts, hopped in and closed the van door behind him. He stuck the M60 out of the back door glass and yelled to Hadid, "Drive, Hadid! Stay behind them!" The two vans drove down the curvy road through the woods. It was meant to be a training ground for Navy personnel, but it was repurposed into a rural retreat for presidents and their families. The smooth asphalt roads were made for golf carts or horses for them to enjoy the beautifully groomed forest land that was preserved with the camp. For security reasons, the roads were never mapped on paper. Only those who had actually been to the camp knew where the roads went and how they connected to one another. It was easy to get lost, but not so hard to walk out of the woods if you stayed on the roads and followed the blue arrows in the middle of the road leading out. Right now, they were driving against the arrows. "Where are we going?" yelled Jones up to Hadid. "We're following John. He knows the way," yelled Hadid over his shoulder. "People call me Rhino," said Rhino, holding his hand. Holding out his right hand as he climbed into the passenger front seat of the van. "Agent Yafil al-Hadid. People call me Hadid," he answered, releasing his right hand from the wheel. "It means iron rod," said Rhino. "Actually, iron bar, but that sounds okay," said Hadid. "Do you speak Farsi?" "Samoan," he said, pointing to himself. "I played football with people who did, though. That's where I learned the name before." Hadid smiled. This man was easy to like. His heart felt good. Is the president here? He's coming on Marine One. We'll meet him at the access door. Way cool. Rhino was excited about meeting the president. He was 26 years old, but only voted in one election. This one. He wrote in Robert Riker's name, along with 50 million other people. It was his way of sticking it to the man. Do you guys know where we're going? Bet asked Smith. I know where it's located, said John. Smith did not answer her. He looked straight ahead. He changed. Shots had been fired, which meant their mission had been compromised. These were not terrorists, he reasoned. These were federal troops. They knew they were arriving, even though no one in their group had communicated with anyone outside. They had changed their flight plans en route, been to the edge of space, and flown with a dark transponder. There is no one on Earth that could have tracked them. Crap, he said softly. I know, said Enoch. It's him.